Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome to the Psycho Vertical Podcast. It's me again, Andy Kirkpatrick. Where am I today? I'm somewhere equally as exotic as a I'm trying to be more like BBC, so I keep going out to places. So I'm just in my shed, so it's not that exciting. It's a Saturday afternoon. My son is asleep in bed, having his nap, my youngest son, who's not two yet, and I'm putting on my rubber gloves. Can you tell what I'm doing? I'm putting on my Medihands, my latex gloves. I'm actually fiddling with a with an outboard motor. I'm like a real man. What am I doing? It wouldn't go into reverse properly, and the reason was when I changed the impeller, which is the little bit of the inside that spins around, that circulates the water through the engine, so it doesn't explode. I didn't put the connector back on properly, so I'm just doing that at the moment, which is a bit of a fiddly job. That's why I probably didn't put it on properly the first time round. So I thought I would kill two birds with one stone. I'd do my podcast, and I'd do this at the same time. What else I need to do? I've been servicing this engine for ages. I've slowly been taking it all apart. That's my weights and nearby. Yamaha, very good. They're they're great. They have really good instructions, their old instruction manuals. I was wondering if Petzl or somebody, if that kind of inspired them for their kind of instruction manuals, because they're very, very similar. The kind of instruction manuals that you can use, even if you don't speak English or Japanese or something. So you can imagine someone in the middle of nowhere being able to repair something. Yeah, that's the problem I can see now. So when it's in reverse, that's it. So what else I need to do to this engine? There's something else. I told this story last time anyway, but I've still not mended it. I was in the middle of a lake. So the lake near here, it's called a Korub. I think it's one of the biggest lakes in these islands, these here islands, so including the UK, and on one end there's like some quite big mountains, like the highest mountain. If we call this the British Isles of England, Wales, Scotland, Ireland, the British Isles, and like England is Great Britain because it's the biggest of the islands, not because it's great. And so the highest mountain in the British Isles is actually in Ireland, not in Scotland. So, which is actually a really great mountain down in Kerry. Highly recommend people go and climb it. There's a very kind of loose, kind of like almost like climbing in the Rockies kind of ridge that goes up it, which is Howling Ridge, which is like, if you can find a good hold on it, you might as well take it home with you, because that's, you know, it's probably worth something. And I remember did that with Vanessa when she was pregnant with Noah, and I think she was probably like 7 months pregnant, so she was like really pregnant. And when you get to the top, there's like you basically top out almost right at the very top of the mountain, and there's a big sign that says, you know, like, danger of death beyond this point. And there's all these like people like eating their sandwiches, and then this like this guy comes up, and then behind him like waddles this woman with a like pregnant woman. It was quite funny at the time. So that's anyway. So the Corrib, it's at the bottom. You've got this. It's kind of weird. On one side, you've got limestone. On the other side, you've got granite. So it's like some kind of big geological fault, which filled up with water at some point. And at the other end, you've got the Connemara kind of mountains, which some of them are. There's a horseshoe there. Some amazing walks up there that no one ever goes there. It's like completely empty place. So it's where all the brigands and people used to live. Like the British built like loads of like roads and things to sort of carve it up, so it was easy to get the army around and chase after those brigands. So anyway, but when the wind like right behind that is the Atlantic Ocean. So the wind comes in, goes up on top over the mountains, and then drops down onto the Corrib. And the Corrib is like a series of lakes, and with like, you know, sort of joining together. So it's because they're narrow at the end. Do you know what the throw is? Yeah. So you get the wave, and the wave like builds up to a certain height, and when it gets towards the end of the lake, the wavelength is. Would it be shortened, or would it get bigger or smaller? I'm not really sure. Anyway, the wavelength, basically, because it gets narrower, the waves like increase in height. So you can have like quite small waves at one end, and at the other end, it's really big. So anyway, so loads of people die on the Corrib, because it's people go out in their little boats, and it's nice weather, and then it sort of, you know, goes like really grim, and they drown. And there's loads of rocks under the water, so it's fairly deep. But the first person to survey it was Captain Blythe of Captain Blythe, Mutiny on the Bounty fame, and he came over to Ireland. That was his job. So doing that kind of job, which is kind of interesting. No, damn, that should be neutral. I can't quite get this to go into reverse. So that's what was my point? Oh yeah, so I think I told this last time, my last podcast. We were out on the lake, and we managed to the engine stopped working, like right in the middle of the lake, and we had to start rowing. Well, Vanessa rowed. She's although she's like massively, she's like pregnant. She kind of likes that kind of thing. So I just like sat there, watched. Very modern kind of thing. I listened to a podcast recently, and they were saying about that men have never been, there's never been a point where men have been so, there's been so many men not in the business of working, job market, and a lot of them are down as being disabled, and a lot of them are, you know, a lot of them just never had a job, like loads of young people never had a job. And they were like looking at the stats, and a lot of these people watch on average about 2,000 hours of screen time a year, which is the same as having a full-time job. So So yeah, why that is, it's kind of interesting thing. So right, let me get this thing back in again. Yeah, I was gonna tell you that was leading up to something, but I've forgotten it was now. I think one thing I was gonna talk about was I still got all these stupid questions. I've got these questions to answer, so I'm gonna answer one of those today. Actually, age and ages ago, I wrote some article, and it was about going back to, this was like a long time ago, probably like 2014 maybe. Like, I went back to Hull, like where I grew up, and it was a friend of mine from Hull. He was doing a degree when I was living in Hull, and called John Doran, and he went off, became like a journalist, worked for, you know, magazines and stuff, and he ended up starting that music website. It's got the same title as The Drug Out of Children of Men, I can't remember what it's called. Anyway, it's quite a popular music website. John Doran is called. Anyway, the something. Anyway, it's good. So I'd sort of bumped into John like over the years. I actually went climbing with him one time, and he actually ended up being part of a book. He wrote like a autobiography, and there's like a whole chapter about me and him going climbing. And like at the time, he was basically like a drug addict. He was definitely an alcoholic, and he was also like a drug addict. Like, he's from Liverpool, so he for some reason we're going to go climbing. What he wanted to go climbing, I think it was part of him trying to stop being a drug addict. And he was like a journalist living in London, so it's you're not going to manage to do it doing that kind of thing. So anyway, we went to Wales, and we decided to go and do, what was it, basically a scramble. Maybe it was like Groove Duret or something, but I'm looking back on it, I think that might have been too hard. No, I think it was Groove Duret. And he was just like, I don't know if you've ever been climbing with a drug addict, but he was just a total mess, do you know what I mean? And it was like quite a warm day, and we started walking up to Groove Duret, and he had this like woolly hat on, and I'm like, John, like, why are you wearing that woolly hat? And he's like, oh, because whenever I have like really bad, if you ever take like acid or some really bad drugs, I always know that if I've got this hat on, I'm going to be okay. So that's why I had his hat on. So I remember there was a bit where there's like a dead sheep as you were like walking up the trail. So, yeah, if you've ever done Groove Direct, like, you kind of walk up to the side of Triffin, and then you kind of traverse around this sort of ledge thing, this path. And as we're walking along, there was like a dead sheep just like there on the side of the path. And I was like, oh, John, don't look down there, there's like a dead body. And he actually thought there was a dead body. Like, he really thought like that was the kind of how extreme it was climbing Triffin. So I carried on walking for another 10 minutes. And when I looked back, he still had like one hand like covering half his face, so he couldn't see this dead body. So we got to the bottom of the route, and I think did he drop the belay plate straight away or something? It was one of those, you know, when you go climbing, people who aren't climbers, you're just kind of soloing. You're like a mountain guy, basically. You're just kind of soloing along with like a rope, and he's kind of, you know, just to bring them up afterwards. So I was like climbing, I climbed up, and yeah, he was just a state. Do you know what I mean? I think that's often the thing when you're a climber, you often don't realise how hard climbing is for people who aren't climbers, you know, just the basic kind of stuff. Like, even stuff where like, oh, there's a crack there, and they're like, what's a crack? You know, or there's a there's a foot all day, and like, what's a foot? You know, they get really, they kind of get really freaked out. And I think the crux on there, is it like the chessboard or something like that? So I'm just moving my engine around. I think all the, got to change the oil now. There's a thing like called the chessboard. And somehow we managed to do that, which is quite, just pretty impressive. Let me just get down on my hands and knees. So there it is. I never changed the oil on anything before. Neat. Yeah, so we managed, actually it was three of us. We had somebody else with us as well. And he eventually, you know, he's like so hot. He was so sweaty and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, but we get to the top of Triffin, and there's all these like people like milling around. And you could just tell he was just, just like totally freaked out. But at the same time, he was like massively relieved. He's like, oh my, I've made it to the top. And, it was like a big deal for him really. And then he suddenly like looked around. He was like, how are we going to get back down again? He hadn't really thought about that. So the getting down was, he basically went down the whole way, like on his arse, like sitting on his arse, all the way down the side of Triffin. It was like pretty embarrassing for everybody concerned. But by the time he went down to the road, like he didn't have any, he basically just like his naked arse, like he worn his trousers all the way to, there was nothing left of them. So, anyway, so John wrote this book. What's it called? It's called Happy Lad or something like that. It's supposed to be good. No, I've not read it, but it's supposed to be a good book. So I'm now trying to do my engine. Yeah. Vanessa made like some engine stand out of wood. I'm never quite sure it's up to the job. Right. So I'm going to drain the oil out of my engine, out of the gearbox. So he wrote this book, and I came over to Hull, and it was like what's his website called? It's not The Revenant, it's something like that. Anyway, so I came over to Hull, and he had like some Norwegian guy, he was like famous in a band, and I think he was going to do some, he read some sort of chapters out of his book, and they played some music, and then me and him, I don't know why, but me and him had like a little chat about stuff, and it was pretty good. Anyway, but while we were there, God, I'm forgetting that one. Yeah, while we were there, this guy came up, John the Goon. So I do apologise, John, if you're listening to this. Yeah, we used to call him John the Goon, and so his name's John. And I actually went to school with John the Goon. I remember him being at school. It's kind of weird because you go to school and you have all these people you kind of know from school, but you're not really friends with any of them. But then when you kind of leave school, you kind of end up with a different sort of set of people, and none of them were from your past. And then one day you kind of bump into one of them. It's a bit like being a spy or someone pretending to be someone else, and then you meet someone who knew who you actually were or are, and vice versa. So John the Goon was there, and yeah. So when I was at school, I always thought of John the Goon as being one of those like swotty kids. Like he always seemed like a smart kid, and I wasn't a smart kid. And God, I can't get that open. So I always imagine someone like that. They're going to go off to like university or whatever. Like I'd love to know how many people actually went to university from that kind of year at school. Because my sister was in another school, which when she got her O levels, whatever, it was the lowest performing school in the entire UK, And the for some reason they decided to amalgamate these two really terrible schools into one school, into one really massive shit school instead of two small shit schools. And then eventually they just like knocked the whole school down, hopefully with all the kids in as well and the teachers. So anyway, I'd not seen John the Goon. I don't know why we called him John the Goon. I didn't call him John the Goon. It's just that when I kind of met him again when I was a kid, you know, when I was like 18 or something, you know, people called him John the Goon. Because he was like, all the people we hung out with were all students, basically. So me and John the Goon were not students. We were like, we were on the dole. And luckily we managed to befriend all these students and realise that although we weren't capable of getting to university, we're probably just as hardworking as these people who were in university. This was in the times when people didn't pay for a degree. You just went and did a degree, and the state paid for it. Which, looking back on it, was probably a bad idea because, you know, none of them seemed to really care about the fact that someone was paying them to get a degree or whatever. And those were the days when people were like, oh, a degree's a degree, where now it's not, it's just like a degree, it's just like a form of debt, probably. So John the Goon was there, having not seen him for maybe like 20 years or something. So I started talking to him, and he kind of looked exactly the same. Like, maybe I looked exactly the same, but I definitely wasn't the same person. Like, when I knew John, I was like, living in a hallway, like in a squat, like signing on every 2 weeks, and that was the kind of my lot, really. And anyway, he told me that he was basically had been unemployed, like really not had a job after all those years. He was still kind of unemployed, and he was on some kind of, you know, you kind of get off the employment register or the list of people who are unemployed by sort of faking you've got some illness. They'll say you've got some disability and they'll just take you off the figures and say you're disabled. And or they'll, you know, this tax credit. So John, this may be unfair saying this, but my impression was John had a business selling like nuts and bolts on eBay or something, and it probably wasn't making any money, but the government would just pay you the difference, so you had like a living wage and the government paid it through tax credits or something. So maybe I wrote about this at the time, but you know, you're best not worrying too much about people you know, thinking, you know, reading what you write, or you know, you don't think like that, 'cause you'd never do anything. But about a year ago, I was on like a podcast, what's it called? Unconventional Soldier podcast. And I kind of, for some reason, that came up about John, but I didn't mention John's name. But I doubt anybody would know if you said a guy called John who lives in Hull. I don't even know who it was. Anyway, so but I mentioned, oh, I knew this guy, and you know, he's like basically never had a job in his entire life, and isn't that terrible? You know, I'm not being judgmental about John. I'm just saying that's a really, like, maybe he's been doing amazing stuff and he's not had a job, you know. Maybe he's been working for Amnesty International or something like that, making dream catchers or something for like orphanages. I don't really know what's been going on, but it doesn't really matter, because it's just for me, it like represents quite a lot of, you know, you see it all over the place, that kind of thing, like a waste of someone's potential and human capital and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, so I kind of mentioned this as a throwaway comment on this podcast, and a few weeks later, I had an email from John. So I've not talked to John since like 2014, and like rightly so, he was fucked off. You know, he's like, you don't know me, you know, you don't know my circumstances, and all that kind of stuff. And like, generally what I do in that situation is just get really defensive and stuff like that. Like, I just, you know, I really should own up to it, but it's best not to own up to anything, I don't think, because you'll only regret it later on. You just got to stick, you know, where you've just got like stick by your guns of the pet. You know, it seemed like the right thing to do at the time to exploit someone's life for some meaningless anecdote or blog or whatever. But and you know, it doesn't really, as long as you don't identify the person, really, it's only they can be offended. But yeah, so but instead of saying I'm really sorry, I'll go and remove the offending thing, and I'll get them to take the podcast down or edit that thing out. Like, you haven't got time for all that bollocks. So I basically told him the truth. I was like, when I first knew you at school, you were like one of the squatty kids. Like, you were a kid who was intelligent and he seemed to work hard and he seemed to be going somewhere. And you know, so when I met you all those years later and you're still in the same situation, still in hall and everything else, it was the fact that I actually expected more from you than I probably did from myself. That was what was shocking. There was loads of people. There's a, you know, someone at my mum's funeral, I found out, you know, someone I went, you know, basically one of my best friends at school, you know, ended up like a drug addict and all that entails. And but it wasn't really surprising to me to be told that. Sorry, if you're listening to that, I won't mention your name. But you know, some people just know it's not that surprising, really. But with John, it was surprising, and so I kind of, I mean, I don't know if I apologised, but I tried to. Like, sometimes you do need, you know, you do need someone to be honest to you. Like, this is my, instead of just being like, oh, I'm very, very sorry, I shouldn't have said that, blah, blah. It's like, no, fucking hell, I should have said that. Like, I should have said it to you at the time, maybe, because that, now you've lost another, you know, a lot of time. And you kind of do need people who are like assholes in your life. Definitely if you're writing, it's always the people who are the most critical, the people who you feel like standing behind you all the time. Not standing behind you, but they're literally standing behind you to like whack you over the head. You know, like, that's not good enough. You know, you're useless. You know, you'll never amount to anything. It's like, I'll show you. And is it Ed Stafford? So it's starting to, I don't hear that rain. It's really starting to rain outside. It's like, the weather's like mental here. Anyway, so Ed Stafford, he wanted to walk down the length of the Amazon from the mountains all the way to the sea. And he eventually did it. I think it took him like 2 or 3 years. And he said at the beginning, like, no one believed he could do it. Like, everyone he talked to, like every expert, they said like, oh no, it's impossible. Oh my God. He said it's in, maybe we have to stop recording this to like wait for this rain to go. They said it's impossible. And he said the only people who really believed in me were my mum and dad. And he said the problem was they didn't know what the fuck they were talking about. So, yeah, so you know, it's a difficult thing to listen to criticism, or, you know, some people just don't want you to be successful. And some people kind of know you well enough to know that you won't be successful. But no one knows you as, you know, no one knows who you really are deep down and what drives you. Like, someone saying that you'll always be unsuccessful is, for some people, it's enough to make them, you know, a success, where other people, it's like, oh, fair enough, I always thought I was going to be shit. God, can this get any worse, this weather? You have, like, very impressive hailstones today. Welcome to Ireland. It might calm down. The Atlantic Ocean is literally about 200 metres from my house. So this is like a proper squall coming off the Atlantic Ocean. Right, I'm going to go back. I'm going to get back onto my hands and knees and try and undo this screw. I don't have to go inside.
got one screw off. Another screw off, where's another screw? Right, so I think it's died down. Great radio. Oh, yeah, I've got the screws coming off. So now, hopefully, there it is. There's the oil coming out of my gearbox. And the gear thing. Looks like an advert for Castrol. It's very impressive. Yeah, this morning it was like really hammering. It had like huge hailstones. It's funny, John, people always going on about this extreme weather events and all that kind of stuff. Like, I think one reason why I'm always kind of very skeptical about that is like when you travel around places, if you like look around at things, you often see, historical bad weather events and, famines and, all that kind of stuff. They basically happen all the time and always have done. God, you can imagine like living in Ireland. It's like in the past. the Romans not called Ireland like Ambrosia or something, because they said that when they arrived here, it felt like everyone was asleep. I think they're probably just all indoors. The clothing was probably very similar to like the Scots, in that they would have like a woolen blanket, not like a kilt, but like a thing that you could wrap around you in loads of different ways. It'd be like kind of ideal for this kind of weather. It's really weird that there's no real like indigenous clothing for this. Oh my God, it's mental. I can see some brighter skies. It might calm down. You need a good roof around here, that's for sure. This would be a really good place to test clothing, test waterproof clothing. Like, I used to be like a Patagonia clothing tester, so I used to get like a jacket or some trousers, and it'd be like two different materials like sewn together, so you'd have one green leg and one black leg and various things. So you'd always like walk around looking like you were a clown or somebody. You definitely need to live in the right kind of location for testing clothing. Like, if you live in Utah or somewhere, it's probably Colorado. It's not ideal. So yeah, better get on. What was I going to talk about? Actually, it was interesting about not wanting to change things. Like, I recently, Cody, this guy who'd recently like committed suicide, he was like an Instagram person. You watch his things on Instagram about climbing techniques. Like, he committed suicide, and I wrote like a tiny little thing, and stuck it on my website and on Instagram and stuff. And it was basically it was something that came about because my mum dying as well, is that like when someone dies, like suddenly you don't get the opportunity to say all the things that you wanted to say, or to say sorry, or to all that kind of stuff. And so when you commit suicide, it's if you just die suddenly, it's not your fault. It's just the way it is. And my mum died like a blood clot. It's not really your fault. But if you commit suicide, it's like I wrote it was a little bit like a fuck you, really. It's like a fuck you to life, is a fuck you to the people who care about you, because you're not giving them like an opportunity to say what they want to say before which is probably like don't do it or don't go. But it just leaves a lot of guilt, everyone who's left behind. And so I had someone email me, and he said that he thought it was unfair to say the word fuck you, like it was disrespectful maybe to to his memory that he would be thinking like that. But again, like as normal, I was just defensive, and I was like, it was just like a general thought about people committing suicide. It wasn't, you know, I don't really know anything about his situation or whatever. So I ended up writing like a much longer thing about suicide and thoughts about suicide. It's a bit like, I wonder if it's a bit like, you know, people say, oh, you can't be the Prime Minister because you've never been poor. Or like, oh, you know, so if someone's been the Prime Minister or like a president and they're like a millionaire, people are like, you should be the Prime Minister because you've never been poor or something. Is that similar thing about you can't be a cancer specialist because you never had cancer. It's that kind of, you know, that kind of thing. And I've never committed suicide. I've always been very interested in it. It's a very interesting sort of topic. It's probably one of the most interesting topics. People sort of self-murdering themselves. So anyway, I wrote something else. But it did make me think again about this thing about not deleting things. Not if you're writing, maybe it's not right. I have got a thing about not wanting to say sorry as well. If you ask Vanessa, you probably, you know, if I do something wrong, I really don't like saying sorry. You know, apologising for things, it definitely is a fault. But when it comes to writing, I think it's very rare I ever go back and delete something. The same with like tweets or Instagram posts. It'd be very easy to go back in time and if you like thought something was a great idea, like the invasion of Iraq or something, and you thought you were gonna, you know, you thought the weapons of mass destruction was a big problem, then, you know, you could go back and delete all those things where you were supporting those kind of things. But I think you have to kind of live with the good things and the bad things. Like at the moment, I really, you know, for me, this whole thing that's going on in Iran is actually exactly the same what happened in like Libya or Syria. It's nothing to do with what you think it's to do with, and it's, you know, it's much darker than you think. And but yeah, it's almost like people do go, maybe people don't really, like someone that I listened to, someone was saying that it's not that people don't care about what's true anymore, they don't even care that they don't care. which is because it was about the you know, they said they found all these, you know, 1,000 children's bodies in First Nation schools and things in Canada, and it was like, you know, a huge thing, and you know, churches got burnt down and everything else. It turns out that never happened. They never found any bodies, but we just it just created this this mass kind of psychosis, and yeah, you know, but people just kind of move on. It's very weird. What's my point? I don't have a point. But I think, I guess it's just do what you do and just stand by it. And if you were a complete asshole for saying something or doing something, or if you were right, you know, you should treat both things. You know, you're right. You're unlucky to be as wrong as you are, and you're probably lucky to be as right as you are about things. So, and if you're afraid to be wrong about things, then you probably never do anything at all. So, God, the rain's coming back. We had like a brief, like right around here, when someone says, oh, the weather's nice, they literally mean like right now, right in this minute, the weather's nice. Like we had a little bit of nice weather there, but it was only a soft rain. And you know, you'd probably be drying quicker than you got wet if you went out walking in it. Someone asked the question, back to the equipment thing. Someone asked the question. It was basically about these like single skin mountain tents. Like in the past, it'd be like a Bibla tent or a Black Diamond tent, and now you've got MSR tents, and I think Decathlon make one. There's that other company, I can't even know how to pronounce it, Mountain Hardware make one. And the person was using it,
in the Alps, and they just basically got like piss wet through. So it was basically so this one is my kind of thoughts on it, how you stop, you know, how you deal with condensation and everything else. So I wrote like a, I think if you ever look up, if you try and Google the MSR something, you know, the MSR mountain tent, single skin mountain tent, I can't remember what it's called now, and it's called something. If you Google that with my name, you'll find it, like a long article I wrote, which covers, it has lots of advice about how to deal with that kind of thing. But on the subject of condensation, you're always going to get condensation. You're always going to get condensation, like in any tent. But sometimes you're not as aware of it, because like generally a two-layer tent, like the inner tent, the material is actually it's generally kind of absorbs moisture, where the outside of the tent is aquaphilic, is that right? So when you have sex with water. Anyway, so the aquaphobic is the, anyway, so the out of the tent is designed to like repel the water, and the inside of the tent is meant to, absorb the water, really. Like you may have some sort of DWR on it, but really it's there to take that moisture and then kind of spread it all over the place, spread it all over the inner tent, and then the draft through the tent, like the tent has to have some kind of ventilation, that's just going to pick up, you know, your body heat, the sun shining through the fly sheet, all that kind of stuff, that's going to take that moisture off, and it's going to, you'll get the impression that the inside of your tent is dry, where really it's just, it is wet, but it's wet to a degree where you can't really tell, really. So that's, you know, like that's how a double tent kind of tends to work, and that's why a double layer tent with, you know, well ventilated, you know, a good design, you've got plenty of ventilation, is much more comfortable to live in if you're going to live in a tent for a long time. And that's why if you have a tent with like snow valances or whatever, and you start pile loads of snow around your tent and stop any kind of airflow, that's where you're going to get, you know, like more problems with a lot more condensation. That's why, like winter camping, you have a lot more problems with condensation. And I guess also in the winter, if it's below freezing, is when that moisture comes out of your mouth or comes out of your, travels through your sleeping bag and goes up in and hits the fabric, it's probably more likely to condense rather than to be absorbed by the fabric. And that you'll just get, you know, like a micro, you know, a millimeter, you know, the ice will keep condensing until you end up with like ice on the inside of your tent, and some of it might travel through, but probably not. So yeah, that's why you get like icy tents. So if you've got like a single tent, like the fabric on the tent is hydrophobic, so it doesn't really want to absorb, it won't absorb any water. So any moisture that hits it, it's just going to sort of build up and build up and build up until you end up with like, you know, like drops of water. And when the drop of water is heavy enough, or when the tent's like shaking in the rain, in the wind, then you'll just get like the water will either dribble down the sides of the poles, or it will, you know, it's gonna like come down as like a mist on top of you. And if it's freezing, then you'll just end up like a snow shower that's constantly coming down. So most of the mountain tents will have some sort of through flow system where there's like a little zip at the back of the tent, and then there's a zip at the front of the tent. Or you can leave the front of the tent open a little bit more. But often it's quite hot, you know, unless the weather's amazing, you'll often have all events kind of closed up because it's like really windy or something. The wind will just come into the tent. Like a lot of them have like some mosquito netting, like no-see-um netting, to try and stop snow and things like directly flying in there. But it'll just kind of, as the ice condenses on that's going to freeze up as well, so you won't get any any airflow in. You know, you can completely open the front of the tent, so you've got like free. So any because the moisture that's coming out of your body is actually warm, so it's always going to go upwards. It's never going to go sideways. That's why the top of the tent will be wet or icy, and the sides will be generally okay. But you know, so if you can open the tent, the condensation should go out the front, go out the top of the tent, up into the sky. So tents that have a porch. Have like a porch on the front of the tent. A lot adds a little bit of weight to the tent. They are like highly recommended, because A, it's good to have a porch on any kind of tent, especially like a single skin tent. Because if you've got a porch, then you don't have to cook inside the tent, which is you're just asking for trouble if you start like brewing up inside a tent, because if you've got the right kind of stove, like if you're using like a reactor stove or a jet boil, you're probably just going to die, because you're going to get like a lot of carbon monoxide coming off the stove. But like a petrol stove, if you use a petrol stove and say you ran it and you didn't have a pan on it, you can actually generate so much heat that you can actually sort of push all the moisture out of the tent anyway, and that can actually work quite well. You could use that if you had spare fuel, if you had like a reactor stove, you just run it without anything on the stove, without a pan. So you could always bring like a little bit extra fuel just for that, another like a bit more gas, just to be able to run it in the morning, you know, or whatever. So say you were cooking and in the evening and your tent's got to be completely sealed up. You're going to have a bit of air getting in anyway, otherwise you'll die again. You know, you could run your stove a little bit longer just to try and push out that extra moisture through the material. Because although it's supposed to be breathable, it's like how breathable it really is kind of questionable. Especially if it depends, some of them, the material is just hydrophobic. It might be breathable, but it's coated in a way that's kind of repelling the moisture. So the moisture's not going to go through the tent. Unless you really kind of push it out there, so that was one reason apparently, like why the Russians, they didn't really like a lot of the modern jet boil type stoves, because you know they had a big thing about using the stove to kind of improve the warmth inside the tent, which is, you know, it makes like a huge difference to run a stove inside a tent. And if you've not done it, I'd give it a try. Like if you're on like a big climb, like a big wall or whatever, even like I expect the same as like an expedition. You know, when you've got your stove going, you know, it can be like really nice, because it's for the first time you might feel some sort of heat on your face, and you know, it makes a huge difference. Just like an hour of when you're cooking, to just have that heat. But if you've got a jet boils type stove, you generally don't really feel any real warmth off it, because it's too efficient. So that's one reason why I quite like Whisperlite kind of stove, because you can just generate a lot of heat that can help like dry your gear out and everything else. Like if you were going somewhere like the north, like up to the North Pole or into the Arctic, then it's almost impossible to dry all your kit. So you're gonna have to use your stove to dry all your kit off anyway. So that's why people often carry a lot more fuel. They might almost carry like double the fuel you would carry if you were like mountaineering. Just because it creates this kind of like sauna effect inside the tent, just to really dry everything out, dry the sleeping bags out and everything. Whether you can do that if you're on like the side of a mountain, it's probably not as likely. So I would say it's almost impossible. It's almost impossible to get away without having tons of condensation to deal to, tons of condensation And I'm gonna inject this oil into my engine.
Yeah, so it's impossible to get away with it, really, to get away with without getting condensation. So that's why you kind of need a. That's always strange noise. That's why you kind of need a system, which is.
Never done this before. Trying to inject all this oil into my. God. Now that is a messy job. That is fucking messy.
Right. So you need a system that doesn't
matter if it's gets wet and sort of damp, like a. So you need like synthetic sleeping bags,
although a little bit heavier than a damp bag. The difference psychologically, if you're on like open bivouacs with bivy bags, or you're in tents, and generally what you do is you carry one bivy bag and one tent. And if you're on a ledge, you know, if you can only find a small ledge, then one person sleeps in the bivy bag, one person sleeps like wrapped up in the tent like a bivy bag. And then ideally you're going to find places to put your tent up. And but you know, in either situation, having a synthetic sleeping bag like psychologically is amazing difference. Like, you will, you know, if you like, I've done like routes where, you know, on the first night you wake up and your bag's basically piss wet through from your bivy bag or from some situation, and it really weighs on you, because you know that, you know, if things get bad, you're kind of screwed, you know. Like, if you can't get down and your sleeping bag's all wet, you're like, what are you going to do about it? It's kind of very scary. So having a synthetic sleeping bag, it is a little bit bulkier, but it makes a huge difference. I'm a really big fan of I've said on here before, of quilts. Like a synthetic quilt, one that would go for two people. If you're going to be on a mountain where you know you're always going to be able to use your tent, then a two-person quilt is probably lighter overall than two down sleeping bags. And a down sleeping bag is only light when it's dry. Like, once it starts getting wet, it's going to end up being heavier, and you know, it's going to be heavier than a synthetic sleeping bag, and it's not going to be warm. Like, it might not be warm at all. Or even a synthetic sleeping bag that's kind of very icy, it's still going to be almost like 80% as warm as a dry one. So that's something to take into account when deciding what kind of sleeping bag you should use. If you don't have a synthetic sleeping bag, then there's a few things you can do. You've got to try and protect your sleeping bag from the elements, from the snow and stuff. Not from the snow, from the ice and stuff that's going to fall on your condensation. So one way you can do that is if you lay stuff over the top of your sleeping bags. Like, maybe you'd have a bivy bag, but I don't know. Most people don't seem to carry bivy bags the same way as, you know, in the past people didn't really carry. You know, people carried like mountain tents, or probably like Americans who had like bibla style tents. Like, I think a lot of like British climbers, they just use bivy bags because they kind of, you know, grew up climbing in the Alps, and that's kind of what you did. You didn't use a tent on an alpine mountain, really. You'd use like huts, or you'd be sleeping in a bivy bag, or you'd have like a proper, you know, proper tent. You carry a whole tent up there. And I guess like having a normal tent, say, you know, then it would be like a quasar or something, wild country quasar, Terra Nova quasar. That, you know, that's a, that's the kind of tent that you could be using, you know, in the Himalayas, or you could be using, you know, in Alaska or wherever as a base camp tent, or you could take it on a mountain. You know, it's like a brilliant tent. So the single skin tents, I guess you don't want to be using a single skin tent in a situation where you really should have a two skin tent, you know, like a proper mountain tent that you can live in. Like, you want a good mountain tent, you know, you'd be able to live a month in on a mountain and you'd be grand in it. If you use it properly and you don't, you know, make some stupid mistakes with it and pitch it in the right place, something else, then it's good. Where you wouldn't want to be living for a month in a sort of single skin tent. It really is, you know, it's for the mission. It's like an assault tent. You know, you want to be only in it for like as few nights as possible, because there's no room to cook. You know, if you have to sit up inside it, you know, cross-legged, you know, you want to be in your sleeping bag. You want to be cooking in your sleeping bag. You don't want to be like cross-legged, you know, get everything. Like, and also you don't want to get everything out of your, if you can avoid it. You want to cook and then get your sleeping bags out. Don't be getting sleeping bags out and moving around and the snow's falling in them and everything else. It's just like a nightmare. So that's why a porch is good, because at least with a porch, you can dig a little pit in front, so you've got a bit more space to, you know, you can cook inside your sleep with when you're inside your sleeping bags. You can open the porch a little bit to let the air vent through, get rid of the condensation from the stove. Like basic stuff, just try and avoid boiling anything. You don't want to have any rolling boils, because that's going to just pump all that hot water into the tent. So things like laying, like your waterproof jacket, your waterproof trousers, like anything. It doesn't have to be breathable. Anything, if you lay it over the top of your body, over top of your sleeping bags, like zipping two jackets together to make a big thing that goes over the top half of your body, you know, it does make a big difference. Like any condensation or snow that falls down, it will just fall on your jackets and it won't fall onto your sleeping bag. Because if it falls on your sleeping bag, there's a good chance it will, your body temperature will melt it and it will soak into your sleeping bag. So, you know, you can lay like the stuff, you just lay stuff on top of you, on top of your sleeping bags to try and act as like a barrier. Now, and I guess in the past people would use like a bivy bag for a similar kind of thing. But as I said, like bivy bags are almost just as problematical as not having a bivy bag. You know, you'll just have, you'll wake up and you'll just find that there's loads of, like, literally, it looks like you've pissed yourself. There's like loads of water in the bottom of your bivy bag that's been soaked up, and you know, it's best avoiding it. Like I've tended to in the past, I've just been using like synthetic sleeping bag where it didn't even matter if you slept outside in it, it would be okay. You need like one with like a decent sort of shell material. And the biggest thing is having something to protect your head. So you know, if you wanted to, say you're sitting on a ledge, that's the main thing you need in a bivy bag, is the cowl that comes over you so you don't get snow coming into your sleeping bag, and you can do stuff underneath the cowl. And I tend to try and avoid using bivy bags in tents for some reason. I just find it doesn't work. You really want a tent where you've got this like warm period where you can dry it all out, your sleeping bag, the shell can dry out a bit. Like, if it's a nice dry atmosphere with a bit of ventilation, you know, there's two of you or three people in a tent, you're probably creating enough heat to try and that should make it livable. You don't want night after night after night things get really, really bad. And like in the morning, you need to really like clean the get all the ice out of the tent. Like you want the tent to be as free of any kind of moisture, frozen or otherwise, before you pack it away. So in the evening when you get up, you can, you know, it's kind of pretty dry. So if you have got some dampness and it's cold, then just like leave it a minute and the dampness will freeze, and then just like whack it all out. Having a tent brush is good if you've got the weight of that, if that's not a problem, like a little
little brush, a little soft brush. You can buy ones that are designed for that job, or you can just buy a little tiny brush, like brushing into all the corners and sorting all that out. Yeah, like I said, it's in a way, it's all in a way like a single skin tent is just like a slightly upmarket version of a bothy bag. And you know what a bothy bag's like. It's not conducive to do anything apart from not dying, really. So mountain tents, a similar kind of thing. Anything else to add to the mountain tents? I think the rain has now stopped, so for a second I can run back inside, make a cup of tea. Yeah, but they are good. I think like a good mountain tent might weigh like 1 kilo, and a bivy bag, a very lightweight bivy bag, might weigh like half a kilo or less than that, 300 grams. So it's it does make a huge difference being able to get inside it. But I think maybe like everything in life, it's about managing your expectations. Like if you've seen, you know, it can be like horrendous amount of condensation inside one of those things. And if you imagined, you know, it said on the label it was going to be waterproof and breathable, and very often it doesn't seem to breathe, and it doesn't seem to be waterproof either. So you just got to, you know, it's like tough. It's like a tough thing. What you're doing, you just got to be tough. I'm not complaining about a bit of condensation and having a wet sleeping bag. Just be ready for it. If you think it's going to be terrible and it's not, then that's even better. So yeah. So right, I think my son will probably be waking up soon, so I shall go and see how he's doing. My oil has changed. The gears are sorted. And hopefully probably not going to go out on the boat much for now because the weather's you can hear the weather's turning. So anyway, until next time, over and out.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.